You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Even though I like that song, Van Morrison singing "Bright Side of the Road." Whenever you hear that for that long, that's no bueno, right? Okay, so I talked to Jack Riley yesterday, lives in Alabama. You know, Jack, you're going to be on, you want to be on tomorrow? Yeah, what time? Well, noon your time. Okay. Alabama in the Eastern time zone, right? Wrong. It's in the Central time zone. The panhandle of Florida, Alabama. Shit. Now, it doesn't make sense to me, and it fucks me up on a regular basis, okay? I know Florida, but, so it didn't register. So, Jack thinks he's going to be on in 45 minutes, but he's not going to be on in 45 minutes. Shit. So, I just called his cell phone, and now we can go to Plan B, but I don't want to go to Plan B yet. So, shit. Good Lord. I'm stupid, Riley. You're on the radio, so don't say anything crazy, okay? Like you're eating a big fat muskrat right now. But I'm stupid because why do I think Alabama's in the Eastern time zone?
I don't know, Mac. You know, we've been over here in the Central time zone forever, so,
that's part of, well, I mean, look, it's like,
I was just going to say, did they actually teach geography, you know, back in the Stone Age when you were in school?
You know what? They did. But I would tell you that, you know, it's not me, right? It's not my fault, because if you go north, right, Nashville is north of you. It's in the Eastern time zone. If you go north of that, Indianapolis is in the Eastern time zone. Why is...
No, Nashville's... Nashville is in the Central. Knoxville is in the Eastern.
Are you sure about that?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
I'm from the South.
So you know shit like that, because you are from the South.
Yeah, hey, you know, we're educated. We actually wear shoes now.
Well, you know what? Congratulations, because that had not always been the case. I've watched movies. I know that shit.
That's right.
All right, Jack. For people that don't know you, Jack and I met when Jack wrote me an email about an interview I did with Butch Neal, former assistant commandant of the Marine Corps, ACMAC, as we call him, and about a fight in Vietnam that Jack participated in as a squad leader. I believe it is the most decorated fight in Marine Corps history. And... somebody calling me, beeping in my phone, some stupid-ass telemarketer that I hate. So anyway, so Jack wrote me an email about it. He'd listened to it, and then I asked Jack to come on. And so we did a little battlefield study that's awesome. If you haven't listened to it, you should listen to it. And so I like to have Jack on because he's one of the people that have inspired me. And as I've gone down my own path of kind of discovery about how to deal with crappy things that happen in your life. And Jack's been an inspiration to me. He's part of post-traumatic winning. He doesn't really know that. He didn't know that. He didn't know that his quote. Well, goodness, Mac. You know, him speaking Alabamese, he didn't know that that's part of the show every day. So I wanted to have him, drag him back on the program and talk to him about this kind of stuff. So he's graciously agreed to do that. So, Jack, thank you very much.
Yeah, glad to be here, man.
All right. First of all, let's talk about Vietnam for a second, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
What's when you look back, what's the lesson of Vietnam?
Well, I think it's a lesson that, you know, we've yet to learn. It's, you know, we can solve all the world's problems. But the real sad lesson of Vietnam is politicians don't know how to fight wars. They really don't know how to win wars. And, you know, in Vietnam, you know, it took so many good people to die that... you know, they were losing their lives every single day, and it was just another blip on the news, and people in the United States got sick and tired of hearing about it. They just wanted it to end. And unfortunately, the attitude of the military just kept declining. And, you know, I hear people say, well, you know, good men died for nothing. I'll tell you right now, good men died for their brothers fighting right next to them. That's why they died. They didn't die for anything other than the Marine that was on their left and right. Sad commentary, but, you know, for us at the time, we were fighting communism and the world being taken over by communism, and really, for those of us who were actually in the field and saw, you know, firefights were routine, and to see what the enemy was actually doing to the own people, how they were willing to punish their own people. Not because they love their country, but because of, you know, the totalitarianism of communism. You know, when you see children suffer the way we saw children being murdered and used, you know, to get people to do exactly what they wanted them to do, you learned an awful lot about how the world was working at that time and still works to this day in those parts of the world, you know, that still are uneducated and are ruled by communism and socialism, which to me they're pretty much the same. You know, sad lesson for me is I lost in my company over 100 Marines during between 1965 and 1969 when 3-9 was pulled out of Vietnam. An awful lot of just fantastic men so many guys that to me, they're all real heroes, but never be known to the American public because, you know, they'd rather listen to Walter Cronkite say, you know, the war's lost after Tet. So American people just turn their backs on it. And, you know, now I'm not one that's looking for somebody to walk up to me and say, oh, thank you so much for what you did. You know, if we thank anybody, it needs to be in the remembrance of those who died, and then ask, well, why did we put them in that place to begin with?
Did you find it frustrating to watch the nation kind of stumble through Iraq and Afghanistan in a lot of different ways? You know, Don Rumsfeld revives the role of Robert McNamara, and then us commit to things or us go places that we're really not committed to. And did that bother you, or did you try not to pay attention to that, or what were your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I love this country, and I love every single person that's willing to go and, you know, say, I'll fight to defend my nation. You know, I'll be one of the 1% that's willing to put my life on the line, but knowing that what they were about to step into, obviously, you know, I had a, during that time, our youngest son was, he was a sergeant in the Marine Corps at that time, so obviously we had an interest, a very, very vested interest in what was taking place, but anytime we go in and say there's not a real strategy for victory, can't help but, especially for those of us who fought in Vietnam, you can't help but say, well, you know, why are we doing this? How long is it going to take? You know, goodness, how long we've been over there now, 17, 18 years?
Yep. Yep. What? And, 18 years in Afghanistan, and 2003, 16 years in Iraq.
Yeah. So, you know, everybody's giving the president so much grief right now about, boy, turning his back on the Kurds. You know, I heard him with a press conference earlier this morning, where he had the Italian Prime Minister there in Washington, and he said, you know, the question was, there was 26 or 28 American soldiers that he was actually pulling out. Well, it's this. It made it sound like he was pulling out a whole division of the Army, when he was really only pulling out a few men. Now, obviously, what's taking place with Turkey, that's a big issue. I don't think their prime minister likes us anyway.
Right.
I think just study what the Muslim religion is founded on and what their beliefs are, and you have to understand. And if you don't know what the Ottoman Empire was all about, you need to go back and do a little reading.
I want to ask you about when you came home. You have lived a life of service. Is that fair to say?
Well, I've tried to.
But that's fair. You would accept that as an assessment of Jack Riley's time on the planet, that throughout your life you've found a way to serve, whether it be your nation, whether it be your community, whether it be your fellow Marines and veterans. You found a way to do that. Would that be fair?
Right. Yeah.
Where did that come from? And did you, after you came home, and you were dealing with all the baggage that comes home with us, you know, you might go with one sea bag, but you don't come home with one sea bag. You come back with a shit ton of stuff. As you try to, you know, live your life and live your life, I hear you, whenever I hear that phrase, I hear you. You know, but when you think about the role that your service to other people has played in your life, can you imagine your life without that piece of service that has been a common theme throughout your and I guess, you know, what I'm trying to ask is that service is added to your life, and in some way, shape, or form, I believe, because I'm going down the same road, been a counterbalance to the traumatic things that you saw. And I think in a lot of ways, the joy of helping other people, the joy of giving and easing somebody's pain, it pushes back the traumatic pieces that you bring home. And if you can make that a regular part of your life, then I think that joy overwhelms that trauma. Had you always been like that growing up, being a leader and been part of things? Did you sense that about helping others and how much it helped you? Tell me about that.
Well, let me go back to when I was really just a kid growing up. I'm the youngest son of eight children. I do have one younger sister, but I had five older brothers, and of course I had they obviously have a big impact on you, as did my mom and dad. My dad was had been in the Rainbow Division of the Alabama National Guard. Of course, it wasn't, I think it back in those days, it wasn't called the National Guard. It was just called the Alabama Guard. And he was one of those in-betweeners. He was too young for World War One and too old for World War Two. He had been a master sergeant. And so obviously discipline was a big thing in our home, but love was as well. Being in church all my life where, in the Christian faith, we are expected as Christians to provide and serve our fellow man. Now, does that mean that we don't believe in war? Well, of course not. You know, the Bible tells us there'll always be wars and rumors of wars, and even Jesus got mad enough to throw all the money changers out of the temple and threw tables and chairs all over the place. So he was upset. But, I was in church. I was exposed to men who were veterans of World War II. And, these men as Sunday school teachers, as, working with youth, they were obviously a tremendous influence on me. Plus the fact that the majority of the men that I had as teachers in the public schools here in Alabama were, at that period, mostly World War II veterans. So the classroom, back then is much, much different than the classroom of today. So, that being the earliest period of time, but then as you develop these attitudes to what you've been taught, both at home and in our church, I tried to live that out. Some of the best advice, my dad gave me one time. He said, son, before you ever do anything, just ask yourself one question. Would your mama be proud of you for doing it or not? Well, you know, that's pretty simple. But that also had the connotation that, at least in my family, that if my mama wasn't proud of me for doing it, I had to answer to my daddy. And that wasn't always the most pleasant experience in the world. But, you know, you mentioned leadership. Well, for myself, yeah, I was always a leader, you know, whether it be in sports or in school. I was my high school class president, things of that nature. But I think going forward, you know, even to my period of time coming back from Vietnam, I recognized real quick that you just didn't want to talk about it. I didn't talk about it. You know, I think I may have mentioned this to you in one of our other conversations that you and I have had, that, you know, I didn't tell my wife anything. I never wrote her things about anything that had happened. I didn't want to, you know, well, for your listeners, I was married at the time. I joined the Marines, and obviously being married when I was in Vietnam. But I didn't want her to be nervous or scared about the fact that I was there. I'd been wounded in 3 different battles, and that's the scare the you-know-what out of her. So, but after Vietnam and, hey, and coming home...
Hey, Jack, can I tell you something? I talk about that, you know, why don't we talk about it? You know, and I said, you know, we all grow up, and if you had veterans in your home, I blame it on my grandma. Because, you know, you grew up with, you know, your grandpa, he fought in World War II, you know, and he's never spoken about it. And then, you know, your uncle, you know, your Uncle Jack, he fought in Vietnam, and he's never spoken about it either. So, you know, it's this thing that you grow up with that, you know, like, well, I'm a man. I mean, I've been to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I guess you're not supposed to talk about it, because that's how men deal with it. That's how good men deal with it. They're strong. They handle their business. And so I think it's a debilitating tradition that's passed down by the grandmothers of this country that are screwing the rest of us over. So I've got a bone to pick with grandmas. But no, I mean, you get socialized and you hear that. And I think that we do come home with this bias towards, you know, I mean, I can handle my stuff, you know, and I'll go about my business. And what you don't know, what you don't know is you're never going to get over it. That stuff's going to stay with you forever. So I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, you're correct about that. You've got to live with it. But the question is, you know, do you let it just absolutely control every aspect of your life? And, of course, if you say, well, yes, I will, you're doomed. You don't really have, you know, what are you going to do to fall back? The thing of admitting that you may have an issue giving others the thought that you may be weak, and the last thing a warrior wants to ever be thought of is somebody who might be weak. And I think that, above all else, when it comes to the part of talking about it, has kept people quiet as much as anything. You know, the photographs that we saw as youth of the World War I guys coming out of the trenches, and they're just shaking uncontrollably. And, well, who wants to be thought of as someone like that? You know, hey, we're tough. We can handle it. But it's, you know, as you and I both know, it's after you've returned from it, is when you either decide to let the demons control you or you control the demons.
So let's talk about controlling the demons. How, I mean, there was no PTSD diagnosis, right? And guys who suffered from quote unquote battle fatigue, they were looked down upon by everybody else, right? I mean, and I don't mean the combatants, because combatants see it and they know that some people just fall apart. And I don't think a lot of, you know, if you're there, I don't know that you're as judgmental as other people are, but certainly the rest of the culture, you know, they aren't as compassionate. Oh, you did what? Well, what did you do? Did you chicken out? Were you a coward? What do you mean you couldn't do it? And they don't get it. So how did you come to, you know, as this thing keeps, and again, you have layers of it, right? You, as your story goes, you come home and then the VA contacts you and tells you about Agent Orange. And then you get called again. You get told about the Camp DeJourn water thing. And so it's not like this thing, you know, like is one and done in your life. It's reoccurring in your life. And then you deal with your shit every day. How did you, how did you come to, peace? I mean, was the work you did with the reunions, was the work you did with veterans in the region, was that all part of it? Did you come to realize that, or how did you make peace with it?
Well, Mac, it starts out just as dealing with somebody one-on-one for me. Now, I'm just telling you how what happened with me. When I came home from Vietnam, there was no such designation as post-traumatic stress. We all knew that that was there, but how did we deal with it when we were actually in the war theater? Well, we dealt with it by what happened yesterday is gone. Just put it in the past. Don't deal with it. That's the, you know, we've got today's things to try to stay alive today, so don't be worried about yesterday. Now that really sounds to families who had a son or a husband killed the day before. It makes it sound like they were uncaring, but nothing could be, you know, further from the truth. We cared and we cared deeply, but you just cannot let the responsibilities of war, be hindered by dwelling on something that happened yesterday to the point that you're unable to function or do your job, because you not doing your job may cost somebody else their life.
Okay, and that's all good, Will, and I understand the stonewalling piece when you're there. But when you come back...
When you're there. Yeah, now, when you come back, though, it's the... now you're in the... At least for me now, this is for me. I'm in the protect my family mode. You know, my mom and dad are both still living. You know, my mom was one that the first time I was wounded, it put her in the hospital. She was so torn up about hearing, you know, having the Marines show up at the door. And obviously the first thing they thought was I was dead. I think the Marine Corps is the only branch that did that. We actually went to the door when you were wounded. Again, afterwards, for me, it was just, well, don't talk about it. Number one, unless you were there, you're not going to understand what I went through. Number two, why burden your family with things that they don't, they're not going to understand. And number three, it gets back to that, well, if you keep talking about it, you know, folks are going to start looking at you like, well, you know, this guy is just, he's lost it and he's beyond hope. Because he can't deal with what happened to him. That's really what happened to a lot of World War II veterans. Well, veterans from every war. And then for me, it was really making contact with a Marine, and it was the first time I'd ever really talked about it, because come to find out, the old boy was in the 9th Marines, my outfit, and we got to talking, and goodness, you know, I remember thinking how much better I felt after talking with him.
You remember that vividly.
Oh, yeah. Because I couldn't tell you his name. I couldn't tell you. You know, it was just one of those chance meetings where, and I don't even remember. I think we were in a doctor's office just waiting for an appointment. But just having this chance meeting with somebody, and it made me realize that if I could just get in touch with some of the guys that I served with, maybe it'd make them feel the same way, because knowing them like I did, I didn't think they'd be talking to anybody about it either. And for me, you know, it started out, you know, I told you about buying that old DOS program that had every telephone directory in the United States in it.
But tell that story again. So there was a. Go ahead and tell the story, because I thought you wrote different states asking for DOS disk of their telephone directories. Explain.
No. I was actually able to. I was actually able to buy a program that I saw advertised in some magazine, and it was these old DOS disks of every United States telephone directory, by state, by city, and this is, you know, obviously before internet days, and so I thought, well, I'll order this thing, and I get it, and it's good. Now, there's a ton of these disks, you know, the old floppy disk, and so I start looking for guys and trying to remember where everybody lived, and naturally most people tended to, you know, they might live, I think statistically they say that when a guy returns from the military or from the war, he was usually within about 50 miles of where his hometown was. But if his telephone number was in a different city, and, you know, of course I was out of luck, but I was fortunate enough to locate a couple of buddies, who were from the Birmingham area. And, we're still in touch with each other. But that's what started it. And then being able to talk about it with them, which then led up to us, having a company reunion down in Florida. And I think that changed everybody's life.
So the conversation that you have with somebody who you don't even know in a doctor's office at the VA is the pivot point that turns you in a different direction relative to that.
Oh, yeah, because, if you were in the 9th Marines in Vietnam, you were in it, you know. You were in it. And the fact that we weren't even in the same battalion, much less the same company, we still had experiences on each other's flanks so many times, and you know, operationally, that we had I think the biggest thing that our discussion centered on was Operation Buffalo, which was here in July of 1967, and it was one of the, you know, it was one of the times that we really thought the South Vietnam was going to be invaded, you know, by armored divisions coming across the border there.
Were you a part of Operation Buffalo, Jack?
Oh yeah, yeah. We were. In fact, we were the. My company was the Sparrowhawk. Well, you may not be familiar with that term, Sparrowhawk. We were the company that we were in Dong Ha. Our battalion was spread out from GLN to Quang Tri to. We were spread all over that part of DMZ, but my company particularly, we were designated as the one, if anybody got in trouble anywhere along the DMZ, we were the first ones flown in to help them.
And that was
Operation Buffalo. That was started on July the 2nd.
Wait, so just so I know, so the Sparrowhawk was kind of the supernumerary. You were the reserve unit. You were the quick reaction force.
Quick reaction force, exactly.
Got it. All right.
And we were actually on an operation around Quang Tri, and when the telephone message, radio message came to us and told us to move to, you know, back to Highway 1, the trucks would pick us up, take us to the Dong Ha Airport, and we would be heli-lifted right to the battle. So, and my chopper was the very first chopper to come in, and that was the afternoon of July the 2nd after Bravo 19 had been ambushed earlier that day.
You know, I was just with guys from 19 10 days ago, down at Camp Pendleton. Guys who were part of that, and I'm gonna have them on and talk about it. But now you got to come back on and talk about Operation Buffalo, because let me tell you, if you want to know when men were men in the Marine Corps, you know, the Marines who fought, you know, in that movement to contact into the DMZ with 19 and shit, Jack, I didn't know you 3-9. I didn't realize they were part of it.
Look at the operational map for that, and you'll see where 3-9 was had been moved right up on the line there, Just even thinking about Buffalo, you know, it brings back smells. And, you know, we were the ones who actually found the bodies of Bravo and loaded them onto the tanks to.
Oh, those are some. Those
you know,
are some,
of course.
Just so people know, if you look up, right, Operation Buffalo, Vietnam, you will see the pictures Jack's talk about. You will see bodies of Marines stacked on top of each other on the deck of tanks, and
right.
You talk about pictures that will, you know, that when you see them, it's being like punched in the heart. They're awful. They're awful pictures.
It is because you have to remember we started. We finally got to them. The bodies were up around what we call the marketplace.
Right.
And they had been laying out there. This was July the 4th. They had been killed on July the 2nd. So they'd been out there 2 full days. But you have to remember that in 110-degree temperatures and 100% humidity, some of the bodies had already turned black and bloated and... So it was a you can imagine what the smell was like. And that's why I say the smell of death is something that one never forgets.
Okay, now I'm going to stop you there because now you're going to come back on and we're going to talk about Operation Buffalo. But first of all, do you recommend, if somebody wants to understand Operation Buffalo, is there a book that you would recommend to them? Because I've had a couple recommended to me. Is there anything you recommend?
Oh yeah, there's William Keaton Nolan wrote a book called Operation Buffalo: The Marines Fight for the DMZ. I've read a lot of Vietnam books. Majority of them put into the more of a novel. But Keith did an excellent job in really finding veterans and talking to them about what happened. He didn't find me, though. Again, you have to remember this was pre-internet days. He didn't find me till after he had published the book. But I did talk to him about it. He asked me a question. Now, Keith has since passed. He's right. No longer with us. But he asked me, he said, well, you've read it now. I said, is there anything in it that you would disagree with? And I said, yeah, there is. I've got one bone I'd like to pick with you. And it has to do with our company radio operator, who he described in less than glowing terms. And but he's getting this information from a captain within our battalion who I knew very well. And we were very closely until he died. But he is described in less than glowing terms, and I had to take him to task on that, and he said, well, you know, what had happened, we had a command, our CO was going to miss his flight date if we didn't get him out of the field, so we were left without a commanding officer, and so there was a captain in the rear who had only 1 week left on his flight until his flight date, that was running the S-4 shop. But he volunteered to come out into the field and be our CO until, you know, for 1 week. Well, he shows up, again from S-4. He showed up, everything on him was brand spanking new. And he stuck out like a sore thumb, and I told him, I said, sir, you need to get down and wallow in the dirt and get that uniform from being such a bright color of green. But he was one that was wanting to get a good feel for what was happening. He had met with this captain that I'd mentioned earlier and told to, you know, stay put until after they had assaulted this village. But this new CO didn't listen to him. He didn't listen to us. And so he moved forward just a little bit. His radio operator kept telling him to get down on the ground because of snipers. And about that time, a sniper shot him, and he was dead within 30 minutes. So Operation Buffalo was, for me personally anyway, that we had four different commanding officers during our 14 days of Operation Buffalo.
Holy shit.
All because of rotation now. One death and the others being rotation.
Why would you rotate a healthy officer out of that job under that much, when you're doing that much fighting?
His 13 months were up.
So they were stop gapping guys and sending them back.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow. Well, the guy who should, So, okay, now I don't want to talk about Operation Buffalo. You're going to come back on, and we'll talk about that, and I'll get maps,
yeah.
And because let me tell you again, this whole conversation about fighting a peer country. The last time we did it was the northern part of South Vietnam, an area called I Corps, 1966-768, and Jack was there in the middle of it. And he's in the middle of some of the worst fighting. Gatlin's Corner, as I said, I don't know this for a fact, but I believe it might be the most decorated fight in Marine Corps history. And I don't mean a battle that lasted days. I mean a single fight that went on for hours. And
let me just clarify that comment. It was the most highly decorated battle by one company in one engagement. So,
okay.
Meaning that 2-day period of March 30 and 31.
But I want to go back to this conversation in a doctor's office with another veteran, and the way you felt after that, right, leads you, pushes you in the direction of maybe I should get everybody together, because if that felt that good with somebody I don't even know, imagine what it would feel like with the guys who I serve with, I know, and I love, and whose company I miss, and all of that. That becomes the impetus for ultimately for your reunion and then pulling everybody back together.
Well, it certainly was for me. Thank goodness there were other Marines within our company that had one in particular, well, not one, but two in particular that came on board the company during my last month in Vietnam. So I really didn't even get an opportunity to get to know them. But our service there overlapped, but they had a squad reunion, and then that really is what made the big push for a company reunion.
And so on the heels of the squad reunion, the reviews were so good that people said, "Hey, we got to get everybody together.
We got to get everybody.
This is too good.
We've got to get everybody." So that's the first big reunion we had was down in Orlando, and I am so thankful we had that because we're dying every day,
right.
And guys were there that we got to see them at that one reunion, and the next reunion they had already passed.
What year was that, Jim?
So, it was back in the 80s. I can't remember exactly.
So not that long, after Vietnam, and you guys started getting together. You guys must have been one of the first units, but, I mean, that was a lot of guys didn't get together for a long time. Let me ask you this. As you encountered more and more people as they would show up to reunions for the first time, tell me about that. I mean, I've read stories that guys would drive, and I don't know if you've told them, I don't know where I got the story, and I've heard it multiple times, but, guys would drive thousands of miles to go.
Oh, yeah.
And
we have a Marine that I'm sure he wouldn't mind me telling you his name, but I won't, I wouldn't want to wake him up. Make him feel bad or anything, but he drove from Ohio to Orlando. There at the hotel where we're having the reunion, and he and his wife. So they make that long trip down there. They get there. He drives around the block of the hotel twice. And drives back home. Never got out of the car. Just because he didn't know really how he would feel. He didn't want to, as he says, embarrass himself by breaking down or anything. And he really fought coming to a reunion for several years, and And every person, it don't matter what outfit you're in or what branch of service you're in, if you're ever invited to go to a reunion, the best thing you can ever do is go. It will, if you are a combat veteran, it will change your life. And I mean change your life for the positive. I could not tell you, Mac, how many wives of our Marines have come up to me and said, Jack, you insisting that they come to the reunion was the best thing that could have ever happened to us. Now, if you want to feel good, if you can't feel good after somebody tells you that, something's wrong with you.
Yeah, you must be an Auburn fan. Jack, is that, and you know, Jack, one thing that I talk about is when I talk to people about this thing that I call post-traumatic winning, and that is telling people what you just said. And look, it's one thing for you to learn about this stuff and for you to live with it and you to endure it, what you have to live with, better. But that, we're Marines, that cannot be where this ends because, right, if you want to live a great life, go change somebody's life because there's so many people, both veterans and people that aren't veterans, that are living with so much pain and they don't want to talk about it. And they live in this blackness, and you can, I tell Marines, you can change that. You can tell them that there is nothing wrong with it. They're not going to get over it, right? There's nothing wrong with you, all right? And you may be damaged, but as one of the ambassadors of the land of misfit toys, welcome to the kingdom. Don't worry about it. It's the way it is. And that joy that you feel, you just said, if you can't, If that doesn't make you feel good, then nothing will. And I would tell you, it's the most powerful drug on the planet. And that the DOD and the VA ought to embrace that. And that's what, you know, I'm hoping to change, which is go to the VA and get medication and go to therapy. So what? You can hold up better? Well, screw that. I say, go follow in Jack Riley's footsteps. Right? Go do what he did and watch what happens to your life. Jack, what would your life be without all the positive experiences that you've had helping others reconnect, right? Deal with their pain. What would your life be without all the joy that you've experienced doing that?
Well, you know, I can't even imagine what it would have been. Mac, from a standpoint of, you know, I lost six men that night at Gatlin's Corner. And, I thought, man, that's some heavy baggage to carry around. But then when you get back and you start finding your guys and you start talking to them and you realize that, everybody at some point has this, survivor syndrome, happen to them. You know, why did I survive and men better than me were killed? But when you're able to talk to, especially for me to talk to one of my guys, and then for them to open up to you and tell you, you know, it's not the best thing in the world to hear that one of you men or two of you men or three of you men have been married a half a dozen times and, you know, we're drinking all the time and, that's not something somebody wants to admit to some, you know, especially a brother. But when you get to talking to guys and you really can open up and you start talking to them about what they can do to make every, not their whole life, but the next day or today better.
Yeah.
One of my men, he was a fantastic Marine. In fact, he was the best point man I ever had. And, he was the type of guy if I took him off point just because I was afraid I'd had him out there too long. He'd get mad at me for taking him off point. He's just somebody that relished that adrenaline rush that he got. And for the sad thing about his life after Vietnam was he chased that adrenaline rush as long as he could, and he never could find anything that would repeat it. I mean, the guy had over 1,000 jumps, you know, from aircraft, just trying to get a little bit of that adrenaline feeling back. You know, one of them had been married several times, but once we got to talking about life and what was important about living your life and how you lived your life and what it meant to help your brother, I could see in him that his life was starting to change. He was someone, you know, had been raised in a very difficult situation, uncaring parents, and never had been to church, didn't really know anything about religion, tried to be that old, you know, the old tough guy, you know, I'm tougher than God, you know, fantasizing about fighting in hell. Well, I can tell you right now, I'm the last person that ever won't have to do that. And as he finally understood that helping other people would bring him such joy, and it's sad that he didn't really get to have that much joy after coming to that realization. He was one that Agent Orange had literally eaten up his lungs, and he went through a whole case of those inhalers just about every week, and ultimately he smothered to death in his sleep from his lungs, the outer lining of his lungs had just been eaten away by the disease. But, you know, for Jim, he was somebody that came to know Jesus as his Lord and Savior, and came to know that he could do things to, instead of trying to be the super macho guy, but instead be the guy that looks out to another veteran and say, hey, you know, there's answers for the questions that you have. And they're not in a bottle. You know, they're not in staying out partying all the time. But it's, you know, it's how you live your life and how you look out for your fellow man. We, as a squad leader, you know, the most important thing in the world to me was taking care of my men. Well, after you get out, they're still your men. I don't, you know, Mac, while you were there, you had guys, and I know you still feel like they're your guys.
No, they'll always be your guys, right?
They're always your guys.
That doesn't change.
No, it don't change. And being able to help them, help each and every one of them, but it's not just your guys. It's every veteran out there, and it's not just veterans either. I may have mentioned this something about this the other day too. You know, you just look at how many policemen, state troopers, or, you know, border patrol, look how many guys are being killed every day now on the job, and then look at how many of them are committing suicide. There's 22 veterans a day committing suicide. Now, how many law enforcement people are they committing suicide or committing suicide? It's, and then the kids that are dealing with things that as a high school student, I'd have never even even dreamed of.
Right. So when I tell you, right, that this thing I do that's going around the country, I get up and do my evangelical thing under a tent, and I talk about, and you're part of it. You're part of it. And I say there's two audiences in this room today. Either you're already in the blackness or you're going in the blackness, but nobody gets to the car wash without getting wet. Right? And
very true.
And I'm going to tell you the truth, and if you don't like it, I don't give a shit. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to give hope to the people in the darkness that there is a path. And a path that you can't even conceive this now. And Jack's living it. I mean, let me tell you, I want everybody listening, go and do a search on Contan Tanks, KIA Marines, Buffalo. And then click on the image tab. And you'll see the images, right? And you'll see what Jack was a part of. Okay? That's one episode in his time in Vietnam. And when people like that can say, if you'll give of yourself and if you'll change other people's lives, you won't believe what will happen with your life. And so to the people in the blackness, that gives them hope. And they have a mentor and a leader that's going to show them that path. And it works. It works and it works and it works. And there's no, I don't care what anybody says. And then there's a group that hasn't been touched by trauma yet. And what you're essentially doing with them when you teach them these things is you're inoculating them. Because when it happens, they know what to do. And I had a sergeant from Camp Lejeune come up to me, Jack, about, I don't know, maybe a month ago. And he said, "Hey, sir, it's good to see you again." And I said, "Oh, you were at post-traumatic winning?" He said, "Yeah, I had to go in January and I didn't want to go. But, it was mandatory, so I went." I walked out of there thinking, that's the best class I've ever been to in my life. And they looked at me and said, "But I know you don't suffer from lack of consequence, so I'm not going to pump your tire any." And I said, "No, go ahead." And he said, "No." And then I said, "Thank you." He said, "No, that's not the end of the story." And he said, "My dad committed suicide 3 months later. And because of that class, I knew what to do." So when you look at veterans and say, look, this message is the message of our culture, right? These three goals and nine commandments, and I'll send you a copy of this stuff, Jack, and you can take a look at it. But when you look at a veteran and say, look, we're not done with you. That experience is but a starting point. And for the rest of your life, whenever you cross paths with somebody who's lived with trauma, and it might be a little kid, right, that you can look at them and say, "Hey, could I talk to you?" Right? And, whether you say, "I'm a Vietnam veteran," or I used to be in the Marine Corps. And let me just tell you a few things, okay, that my culture knows that you don't know about living with this and not living an okay life, living a great life with this. If you spend your days with that in your back pocket as you roll around, right, Alabama or wherever the hell you roll around, you will live a great life. You will live a life that's filled with joy no matter how much trauma you've had. And I know that for a fact because that's what I do every day. That's what I wanted to have you on to talk about, Jack, because you are to me a great example of doing it under pretty tough circumstances because your friends, they're still dying of the complications of Agent Orange, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know if you want to talk about this, but and you're dealing with it too, right?
Well, yeah, I've had more Agent Orange related surgeries than I can even count. But last year or the start of this year, really, I had a malignant lung tumor removed, and then last week found out I've got another one in my other lung, so. For we that inhaled and ate and drank and everything else you had to do with Agent Orange, And for the veterans that are listening, you know, at least this time, the Veterans Administration actually put in my medical file that my, since I never smoked, they put in my medical file that my cancer was directly related to my exposure to defoliants in Southeast Asia. So they don't say Agent Orange because there were more than one kind of defoliant. There were many, many of them. But at least that's the first time in my medical file there's any mention whatsoever of relating defoliants to any of the cancers that I've had.
Wow. Could any of that stop you from giving and helping your Marines and fellow veterans? Because you've spent a lifetime doing it.
Oh, goodness, no. I mean, I fully expect, you know, a good result from this one. You'll hear people badmouth the VA all the time, but you won't hear it from me. I think, now administratively, do they have a lot of problems? Sure they do. But medically, I have had nothing but first class medical care at my VA hospital, which is in Birmingham. And, I've had the greatest, you know, most caring doctors, and nurses there that I've had, and I've been operated on in a lot of hospitals, but that VA hospital down in Birmingham is the best one I've ever been in.
All right.
Somebody's going to hear that and say, wait a minute, you know, this guy must have mental problems.
No, you know, you know what's interesting?
I may have,
that's a
I'm speaking from experience, you know, that's, you just have people now, and the fact that they're unlike years past under other administrations, now they're very proactive in treatment. I'm not having to wait forever to have something done. They're addressing things real quick, just like I'm sure they will now with this newfound tumor.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Jack, is it seems to vary by region. Either you have a good team working in a hospital or a not-so-good team. And you know, and so sometimes, you know, you'll hear people wax, you know, eloquent about, you know, and be very gracious. Other times they'll be very, you know, very demeaning. And I think the VA is a big organization.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
And they've got good and bad in them, and good for you that you've got good. I want to ask you if you think this is a fair assessment. If I told you that once trauma enters your life, if you close your eyes now and imagine that your life is a Cessna airplane and it's flying through the air, and once trauma enters your life in a substantial way, that you're piloting that airplane, your airplane, through the weather. And depending on the day, it's got rain and wind, and you're below the cloud layer. And what the VA tries to help you do is try to endure that, right, better. They try to make you, you know, help you endure that through medications and talk therapy and things. They try to build your endurance and help you, whether it be understand it or cope with it or whatever. And what I believe, what I do, and what you've inspired me to do, is I look at people and say, no, I'm going to install a new joystick for you. And they look at you like, what? Like, yeah, I'm going to install a new joystick. And you, and armed with this, you can take that joystick and you can pull back on that. And your airplane is going to go through the clouds and into the sun. So I'm not going to teach you how to endure. I'm going to teach you how to transform your life by transforming other people's lives. Now, do you think that's a fair assessment of the difference between giving and changing people's lives and what it does for you as opposed to just enduring it? Do you think that's a fair assessment or not?
Well, sure it is. Enduring, you know, what good is enduring? You're just, you're having one bad day after another and you're content to live in bad days. Whereas once you understand, if the Bible says it's better to give than receive, if you start giving of yourself to help people who have experienced trauma, and I don't care what kind of trauma, I don't mean wars versus, say, a car wreck where a child's lost a parent. But if you don't give of yourself and then find out the rewards that the good Lord has for each of us who live that out. I tell every person that I've ever dealt with, hey, I get much, much more from them than I ever can give them. Let me give you one example of a lady. This was a surprising phone call that I got many years ago, and it was a gentleman who called me to tell me that he had read some of the things that I had written for some of the men that died with me at some of the battles that I was in, and he wanted to know if it would be all right for his wife to call and talk to me. And come to find out that the wife had been engaged to a Marine, and then that Marine had been killed after, you know, their engagement. In fact, he was due to come home pretty soon, and they were going to be married. And right off the bat, I'm thinking, man, I've had a lot of requests through the years, but having a husband call and ask me to counsel his wife, who still has having issues with, her, you know, fiance who was killed in the war, 40 years ago. Now that's, you know, I am no psychologist, trust me. but I said, sure, I'll talk to her. If I can help her, I'll talk to her. Well, when she called, number one, trying to understand, you know, where was this coming from? Well, it really, started from the fact that she had been given some false information about him, her fiancé, having been captured and tortured. And that's why his casket was closed during the funeral. And so she had been living all these years with this nightmare of what her fiancé may have looked like. But now he had been killed, you know, fairly early in the battle, and he certainly was never taken prisoner. But being able to talk to her and then tell her exactly what happened, and this is why the truth is so important. You know, you need to tell people the truth. They can handle the truth. And for her, finally, after several conversations with her, and me finally telling her that, you know, you need to thank the good Lord that you have such a understanding husband. Because not a lot of men would have wanted to have heard something like that coming from their wife of 40 years. But she finally got to a point that she could, you know, she was better about it. She told me that she was good now. But look how many years she suffered because of that, and you can't tell me it didn't caused their marriage to suffer.
Oh.
So then having her husband call me back just to say thank you. Hey, you know, you're not going to get, if you can't feel good after somebody just telling you thank you, but you never know who may reach out to you. Try to help them. If you can't help them, send them to somebody that can help them. But people are looking for encouragement. They're just looking to hear from somebody that's, the old saying is, you've walked in my shoes, and they understand that you've dealt with trauma. I told one Marine, I said, look, I've been covered with blood from head to toe, and very little of it was my own. Now, I don't know how much more covered than you can get than that. And for them to understand that it's just like having another Marine's blood on you. You go to help them, you'll do anything you can to help that Marine live. And all the time, you know, they're bleeding on you while you're trying to get them to safety. Well, some people may look at that and say, good, you know, they're traumatized by the fact they have this picture of that. No, I have a picture of young Marines who were fighting to live. They wanted to live as much as anybody, but they gave of themselves sacrificially. They never, ever let an order you know, they never stopped when an order was given. They didn't hesitate. And we all knew in some of those situations, none of us might make it out. But we had to complete our mission. Well, now we've got another mission, the way I feel about it. You know, Mac in the Marine Corps, the mission's everything. And nowadays, we've got a different mission. We got to take care of each other. If your family don't know how to do it, if the VA's not listening to you, there's somebody that'll listen to you. I guarantee you, a battle buddy will listen to you. And it's not just to tell war stories, just to talk about how do you really help each other.
Yeah, how do you learn to live with it? And that's the transformational piece, Jack, is that once you help other people, right? I mean, I'd just be curious. After you guys had your first reunion, right? The first platoon or company reunion?
No, it was a company. Yeah.
How good did you feel driving home that night? Or whenever you drove home, how happy was your heart after you had seen?
Well, let me. It was kind of a double edged sword. Remember, I'd never told my wife anything. we're starting to drive from Florida back to Alabama. And my wife's been down there now a week with all of these Marines and fortunately, you know, I had a half a dozen Marines from my squad that were able to come to the reunion. And I wasn't always, you know, right there in the hospitality room able to, because I had other things I was having to do.
So you weren't able to supervise your wife the whole time?
Correctly.
Uh-oh.
I wasn't able to keep her from hearing things so my wife says, you know, all of these guys that were in your squad, and they start talking about all of these things that happened to y'all, and you never mentioned any of that. Well, what were they talking about when? And there came the questions, you know. Well, Mac, after 30-something years, it's time to fess up. And I think for several hours there, I just answered questions. So did she. I think finally that drive home, she finally understood more about me than, and she understood that I was, all that time, I was just trying to protect her. And my boys, I'd never told them Piggly Squad either, so,
Well, now, I want to talk to you because one of the things I say is that one of the commandments, the fifth commandment, if you will, and the only one that's in red is you got to talk about your shit. And the first person you ought to talk about it with is your spouse, because if you don't think that they could hear that stuff and bear it, you're wrong. And I think a lot of people, you know, I think we're just inherently biased, Jack. And I'll tell you a quick story. I'll do this thing, and I'll do a session for spouses wherever I go. And
oh, that's great.
Well, you don't have to explain it a whole lot to spouses because they live it, right? They're the shock absorber. And when it's done, they don't go home. They want to talk. And so this one woman, who I've actually had on the program and interviewed her. She looked at me and she said, you know, you gave me the chills because you said, you use the exact words that he uses. Because I love you, I will never go there with you. And she said, Mac, what do I do? And I looked at her and I said, you know he's dying in there, right? You know that's a lonely place. She said, no, I know, and I can tell when he's there and he withdraws and, you know, and he rejects me. And then it's that, because I love you, I won't go there. I'm going to be over here acting crazy, and I'm going to push you away. And that's how we're going to get this. We're going to get through this as a family because I love you. And she said, what do I do? And I said, well, you got to save him. And she said, I want to, but what do I do? And I said, well, he's a Marine. And she said, yeah. I said, well, I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd stop having sex with him. And she said, the nuclear option? I said, yep. And I said, here's what I'd look at him and say. Before we go there together, we're going there. Okay? And you need to know that I'm dead serious about this. Right? That you need to go there with me so I can know you. Because I hate this. So anyway, that was in, I think, January. In May, I did it again in Quantico. And they were there. Okay? Both she and her husband were there together. So after I do it, she comes up to me and she gives me a hug. And then her husband's a few steps behind her, and she said, Mac, it's different, it's better. She said, it's great to see you. And I said, oh, it's great to see you, Allison. And she said, I want you to meet my husband. And I looked and I said, oh, shit. And I stuck my hand out, and I looked and I said, hey, man, I'm really sorry. And he looked at me, Jack, and he said, no. He said, thank you. She's saving my life. And so, I mean, we're biased to do what you did, right? I'm going to protect you, so I'm going to stay in this really lonely place. And the message I have for people is, you don't have to do that. She can go there with you, and most importantly, you need her to go there with you, so that when you do feel that, she can just walk up and grab your hand and squeeze the shit out of it. So that you know that I'm here all the time. And I know what you've been through, and I love you, and I just want you to know that if you want to talk about it, I'll talk, you know, we can talk. And we need that, right? But we fight it, though. You know, we fight it so much. And I think your example is, and again, I've heard that story. I mean, hell, your friend, Gene Sledge, that's part of his story, right? He'd get up and he'd write on those tablets 1,000 handwritten pages, and he wouldn't let his wife type it because he didn't want anybody to read it. And then he finally does, and his whole life changes when he lets her into his life. And so it's this constant theme in all these different stories. What changed your life? Well, what changed my life is when I talked about it. Or what changed my life is when my second wife told me, and this is Vietnam stuff, my second wife told me that she was leaving. She couldn't live like this anymore. And I knew I didn't want to go down that road again. And I started talking to her about it. And that changed my life. And so, I mean, your story is a great story. And, okay, but aside from you having to come clean with your wife, it must have been a good feeling. Other than that, the drive home, must have been a pretty warm feeling in your heart, seeing all those guys who all of a sudden reconnected and began to have that experience.
Oh, man, I tell you, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like your first reunion you ever go to. In fact, you know, if it was like ours, I don't think we slept for like 3 days because you didn't want to miss somebody. You didn't want to miss, you know, somebody coming in and getting to see them for the first time. And, oh, goodness, we had this one platoon sergeant who came in, and he was a retired, well, he's retired now, but he was a homicide detective. And, now, you know, I mean, after the Marine Corps. And he comes in, of course, you know, like most of us, he put on a few pounds. Well, for him, he put on about like 100 pounds. So, he's just standing there, hadn't walked up to anybody. He just comes into the group and is just standing with his back to the wall looking around. And I'm talking to a couple of guys, and then I turn and spot him. And I told him, I said, you could have weighed 300 pounds and I would still recognize you. And I mean, just giving a big old bear hug to somebody that you just tossed the absolute world off, you know. And he said, well, I'm just going to stand here and see if anybody remembered me. And I told him, I said, gee, won't nobody ever forget you, so please. but their first reunion is, as I said before, it will change. It will absolutely change a combat veteran's life. You know, I felt so sorry for my father-in-law, who was a World War II veteran of the Navy. He got torpedoed twice. He was in all kinds of stuff, but. And he was finally, his ship was finally having a reunion that they had located him, and he was looking so forward to going to this reunion, and then lo and behold, had to have bypass surgery on his heart. Well, he was doing everything trying to get over that, because that reunion meant everything to him. Because we took him to one of our reunions, and he saw the brotherhood and fellowship that was happening in that room. And then, lo and behold, the day he was to leave the hospital, he had a stroke and paralyzed over half his body. So, but he missed that, see, and... I wouldn't want anybody to miss a reunion, and you certainly wouldn't want to miss one just because you know, you think, well, hey, nobody probably remembers me, or hey, if you were there with guys and you served at the same time, your memories are the same. You just need to talk about them. But our reunions have turned into such a fellowship that, good night, we've seen kids grow up. Now we're seeing grandkids growing up. You know, we've been doing this long now. In fact, next year we go to Washington, D.C., which appears to be our favorite place to go.
Can I go?
But we'll be, oh, sure. Good night, yeah. We are having, we're going to be at the, I think we're going to be at a hotel in Alexandria, and then we're going to be at 8 tonight for the Friday night.
Oh, shit.
Ceremony. Oh, yeah, we got 250. We had to get General Neal to get us our tickets because we couldn't get 250 tickets, but he could, so.
Well, yeah, it's good to be connected, right? It's good to be connected.
Oh, man, yeah.
Jack, is there any choice in your mind, now you've lived this life, right, is there any choice whether you ought to simply endure it through medication and go into a therapist and talking about it, or whether you should take it, your experiences, and give those experiences and the truth that we know and change people's life? Is there any doubt in your mind which is the greater road?
None for me. Right. None for me at all. Now, I'm not going to get into all these medical diagnoses that people may have, I'm talking about the everyday grunt that endured and survived war. There is no medicine like rejoining with you men. There is no medicine like it.
Well, and I'll tell you what you've done subsequent in your life in giving of yourself, and whether it was that guy's wife or the other people whose lives you've touched, that drug of changing people's life, it's the drug that you need. I say this. You know, there isn't a drug that can turn traumatic things good. All right, there isn't a drug that anybody can prescribe for you. But drugs may be part of getting you to that place. And you can't talk being covered with blood on multiple occasions. You can't talk Operation Buffalo or the Battle of Gettysburg's Corner. You can't talk that into good. The number words haven't been invented for you to therapy that son of a bitch. Those events to good. The only way you can get to good is to give of yourself. That's how you get to good. And when you give, the drug that you wind up taking, the one that comes to you naturally, is the most powerful drug on the planet. And that's the drug that we need. That's the drug that we need. And that's what you've done your whole life. You know, and I think you're a great example for people about, you know, I help other people. I do it as much as you said earlier. You know, I get more out of it than you get. Ultimately for me, it might be a selfish act because I know how wonderful it feels to help other people, and I can't do it enough, and I do it multiple times a day now, and I'm as happy as I've ever been, you know, in spite of all the shit that's happened in my life. And so
we have to recognize, Mac, that we can't save everybody. Because not everybody wants to be saved. Some people love misery. They love being in misery. And, you know, what we do, though, is plant the seed of what changing their life can be like. God tells us that we're not going to save every person we come in contact with, but we can plant a seed there. That hopefully will grow. Well, that seed for many, it takes a while for it to cultivate, but when they actually do see the difference between the kind of life a person can live in misery and drugged up all the time or in a bottle, that's just a recipe for an early grave. But to be able to give of themselves to the point where they see what good others get out of it. I don't care if you don't help two or three people in your whole life. That may be two or three people that may make the difference in 2,000 or 3,000 people getting better from this.
Well, and
without it just being the negativity that you see all the time associated with, you know, crazy Vietnam veterans, crazy Iraqi veterans.
Don't try to drag us in that pool with you all, right? We know that crazy Vietnam veterans, that's a fact, but crazy Iraq veterans, stand by, dude. Don't be going there. But when I get the DOD to embrace this, Jack, and when you know leaving the military, look, you know more than 99, not, because of McNamara and this post-traumatic winning stuff, You now, leaving the military, you know more than 99% of the population about what it is to live with trauma. And now, when you encounter people, as you go back to your home and you go back to your family and you go back to your community, you make your community a better place. You touch every person that you can. And all you got to do is listen. And then you just look at them and say, can I talk to you for a second? Right?
Yep.
And you say, you know there's nothing wrong with you, right? Who are you? Like, I used to be in the Marine Corps. Are you a therapist? No, hell no, I'm not a therapist. Do I look like one? You know, but you can learn to live with it, and you can live a great life, and don't let anybody tell you different. And so why don't you and I spend about 15 minutes together when you get a chance? And if if we'll do that, then that whole veteran victim bullshit narrative, that's no, we have a mission, man. And in our suffering, we can turn it into joy if we'll help other people. And so there's a better place, and I'm gonna drag the DOD to that place kicking and screaming if I have to, but they're going there.
Well, it is. There's no better feeling than knowing that somebody that you've talked to that's been trying, you know, you can tell these guys where they just given up hope. The guy, and you read about him, Mac, all the time. You know, just this past week, I read about the guy who went down trying to get an appointment to see a therapist at the VA, and they told him it'd be 3 months. He goes out to the parking lot and shoots himself in the head. Why didn't another veteran step up to that? Why didn't a friend that knew him, that knew what he was dealing with, call another veteran that knew him and say, hey, man, you need to talk to him? It don't take a therapist to do this. It just takes somebody that cares about him. Talk to them about it.
Well, you know,
there is life after combat.
Well, and again, I mean, to me, one of the things I say is the facing movement to the door of destructive behavior is isolation. And isolation is not just a one person vote, right? We as friends, we as fellow Marines, we as leaders, we all have a say whether you isolate yourself. And as you say, we can't save everybody. But if I look at people that I know, that I love, when they're struggling, and I say, hey, I'm going to tell you the truth. And I had a young Marine look at me, and he looked at me, and he's crying, and he said, does it ever stop hurting? And I said, no, it doesn't. And, you know, later on he said, that's when you had my attention, because you didn't lie to me. And then I heard you stand up on stage and say, I'm going to tell you the truth, and if you don't like it, I don't give a shit. And then I knew that, like, this was going to be different. And it made me, it changed my life. It made me so happy. And so the movement towards isolation, you know, is ultimately one person votes on that. But the rest of us can say that. And I don't know too many guys if you know they're struggling, and they say, hey, let's go get something to eat. Let's go get a cup of coffee. Let's talk. They're hurting. They want, and especially if they know you and respect you, they'll listen, and you can change their lives. And I know because I do it. I do it all the time. And I've never had anybody say no. The only thing I have happen to me is they'll look at me, and I had a girl who's a friend of my daughter's the other day in my kitchen looked at me and said, could you help my dad? And so you get way more yeses than you ever will get nos, because people they don't know how to deal with it. There is no class on this shit, right? And I agree with you.
No, it's sad when I had a lady at our church come up to me and she's an educated lady and as a teacher and her husband had come back from his latest deployment, and she asked if I would talk to him. And so, you know, obviously that gave me the opportunity to really talk to her, because, you know, just her asking me brought tears to her eyes.
Right.
So, you know, she was needing help herself. But her husband never, ever tried to contact me. And you have to be willing to talk. I can't make anybody talk. And you certainly can't force it on somebody.
But you
but
did,
just for.
But you did plant a seed. You did plant a seed, Jack, and he may not be ready to do it then, right?
Well, the way I had that, the only way I could deal with it was to make sure that she let him know that there was someone who had been through everything he had been through and was willing to talk to him about it when he got ready to do it.
Got it.
And I was just that I was just waiting on his phone call, that I wouldn't force myself to talk to him. But you know, here was the situation. I had a wife and mother who I could talk to about it versus a husband who didn't want to talk about it. Well, I couldn't get both of them, but at least I think his wife got to a point of understanding that his issues were much more different than just you know, combat stress.
Right. Right.
So,
you know, it's an interesting experience. You know, the seed planting. One of the things I want to say, the eighth commandment is, you may if you deal with trauma, you may have to stop drinking, because what unleashes the trauma in a lot of people, what acts as like a code breaker for, you know, the closet that we the lock on the closet that we stuff all this shit in. And that's Vietnam era wisdom, right? Stuff in the closet, lock the door, and don't go near the son of a bitch, right?
Yep.
I called it
my box.
Yeah.
I put it in my box.
Yeah, leave it alone, right? Don't go near that thing.
Yep.
And then, but the problem is alcohol opens the lock on the box. And the demons that come out, they just don't come out for you. They come out for the people you love too, because they're the ones that get hurt. And that's how you alienate people. That's how you wind up living alone or with your dog. And the only reason your dog is there is because your dog doesn't have a boat. And so all of that is significant. And so when the first time I said it on this program, right, if you're struggling with trauma, you're probably going to have to stop drinking. And it was in response to an experience I had with a Marine who was in Fallujah who was struggling. And he would send me emails, you know, when he was drinking, you know, 2 and 3 in the morning. I thought it was Eastern time, but it turns out it was Central time. But anyway, and so I ultimately told him, I said, hey, you got to stop drinking. And he said, I know. And I said, no, I'm giving you an order. Now, I'm out of the Marine Corps, and so is he. I said, I'm giving you an order to stop drinking. And what do you think he said to me, Jack? He said, yes, sir. And he stopped. And so to me, but you know, it's these things that are true, right? These things that are true that have been handed out, you know, that are true in generation after generation of Marines, right? That we don't really want to talk about out loud. And when I say that in this class, and I said, now look, I know there's people sitting in here saying, F you all, dude, I'm going to stop drinking. And I said, and I accept that, but I'm going to tell you, there may come a time in your life when you're destroying it and you're going to come to an intersection. Choose the best thing for you, all right? Choose the best thing for your life. Choose the best thing for the people that love you, all right? And I'll leave it at that. And you know, and that's the, you know, and so that's when people aren't ready to accept what you're saying. The best you could do is plant that seed and hope that somewhere down the road, right, when there's a right amount of sunshine and water, that thing grows. That thing grows. And,
yeah.
that's it. And that's as good as it can get. All right, now look.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I know I've taken up a bunch of your time today, and I know you got stuff to do, so I don't want to keep you too much longer.
No, I was just going to add that getting those calls that, and I've got them, you know, and it's usually somebody that's on the bottle, and it's 12:30 and at midnight, and you know, they think it's 8 o'clock the next morning or stuff like that. But you know, I've got a whole bunch of those calls. And I think my wife realized that that call was a Marine reaching out for help. And you can't say, hey, man, it's, you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Call me tomorrow. You can't do it. Now, you can't always communicate effectively with somebody that's drunk, but... at least in my experience,
you,
at least you can get enough information into them to let them know that, hey, your butt better be up at 0700 because I'm calling you and we're going to have a discussion. So,
and you know, Jack.
But at least getting those calls means, hey, there's somebody that they trust that they can call no matter what.
Well, and that's coming from people that have a whole lot of experience talking to drunks at 3:30 in the morning, right? All over the world.
Hey, if you have to remember my last duty station, I was the duty NCO at the 8th Marine Regiment every other weekend getting Marines out of jail all over the United States.
Attaboy. Well, that's good. That's a fine quality in an NCO. All right, now first of all, thank you for doing this. And this is...
Oh, sure.
No, but this is exactly the conversation that I want to have because, you know, Jack, I go speak to all the general officers in the Air Force in 2 weeks. And this is the story that I'm going to tell them. That, look, your approach is wrong, right? Every program I see is about endurance. And until you can give them hope, you're not going to change, you know, this dynamic. You're going to continue to experience what you're experiencing because it's more acceptable in the culture. But if you do want to change it around, I have a path. And the 2nd Marine Division has gone down that path. They've had on the average of 4.5 suicides a year for the last 24 months.
Is the Air Force?
No, this is the 2nd Marine Division that you used to be a part of.
Oh, 2nd Marine Division. Oh, right. You said the Air Force.
Well, no, yeah. So the data point I use is with the 2nd Marine Division. I'm going to say this to them in 2 weeks. But since they had this class in January, right, they've averaged 4.5 suicides a year before that. They've had one Marine take his life in the last 10.5 months. Marine. So they cut the suicide rate. Now, again, there's still 2.5 months to go. But if they stay on the same pace, they're going to cut their suicide rate between 50 and 75%. They didn't have to create another program because the way you reinforce this stuff is every month in monthly counseling. You sit down with them and you talk to them about them. It's not just performance conduct counseling. It is them as a human being, how are you doing, and knowing them like them. That knowing them like a parent knows them. And I heard General Mattis say, if you don't know them, if you don't love them, then you need to get out. Well, and what he means is if you don't know them like that, then you need to get out because you're not doing your job, and that's what they need. And if you'll do that, there's no reason why you can't have... 2nd Marine Division is 18,000 Marines, 60-plus percent of them under the age of 26. And that ain't, you're not supposed to be able to do that. But if you, as you said, if you tell them the truth and then show them a path to a greater place, guess what they'll do? They'll do it, and then as soon as they do it once and they experience the greatest drug that you can ever take, which is the joy that comes with changing somebody's life, just get out of their way because you won't be able to stop them. So,
that's right.
So anyway, as you can tell, I'm moderately fired up about it.
Well, I hope you stay fired up about it, and I hope there's some way that military will be able to encompass their spouses in this.
Well, let me tell you.
I'm just going to say you're only dealing with half of the audience, unless you can get the spouse to, in there to hear and understand and recognize, so she can then in turn reinforce some of what you're saying, you know, when they do start to, you know, they do get into these moody episodes that they tend to have.
Yeah, well, you know what, and here's the thing. What spouses tend to do is they get, in my opinion, they give us too much space, and they accept this. Well, it was combat. Well, let me tell you this. Or it was this. You can't understand it because you're not a Marine. Well, I hear that, and I think of my sister, who lost her only two sons when her husband shot them both in the head when she said she wanted to leave, and then killed himself. Now, I know people that have seen some really, really terrible stuff, but they're not in my sister's zip code when it comes to this stuff.
That's as bad as it gets.
Right, and women tend to give us too much space, in my opinion, and they shouldn't. And I tell them, you have to rescue him, and all you're trying to do is say, hey, look, I want to go there with you. I love you. I will always be here. But that guy I heard talk, he told me that I should not accept your bullshit, and so I'm not. And you and me, boyfriend, we're going to talk about it. Or you and me, girlfriend, we're going to talk. And the only thing that will come out of that is good. The only thing.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, shit, Jack's wife did it to him. Okay, boyfriend, trapped in that car driving back from Orlando. That thing got kind of small, I'm thinking.
Buddy, I had the third degree there for about 500 miles. So.
You know what? Let me tell you this. A guy who knows you, and I don't. His name is Ken Rogers. He knows of you from All Marine Radio. And Ken made a movie about Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marines at Quezon, where he was a Lance Corporal. His second wife's name is Betty, and he went to a reunion after they had got married and took her for the first time. And so he's visiting, and I don't know if he'd help organize it, but she was sitting there, and she had the exact same experience that your wife did. She's listening to all these things that she's never, ever heard of. And she looks at him and says, boyfriend, we got to talk. Right? And then Marines, they always do the same thing. What? Like, what did they say? What did they say? They're just talking shit. Don't believe anything they say, right? Don't believe. And then they just look at you and like, we're not going to play that game, okay? And then you think, damn it, right? Damn it. But just like with Gene Sledge, just like with you, just like with Ken Rogers and every other person that's been brave enough to say, okay, what do you want to know, right? And when you open that door and allow somebody else in, it's the beginning of transforming your life. Because you're starting to talk about it with somebody who loves you more, you know, than just about anybody else on the planet. And that was a must have been an interesting ride home.
Well, it was. At least, you know, I felt like I didn't have to ignore the fact anymore. Of course, you know, once she was around my guys, we were family, and we have been ever since. Those of us that are still living, anyway.
And she understands you better, right?
Oh goodness, yes.
And that's a good thing for you. Absolutely. It's a good thing for you and a good thing for her. So you can think or say whatever you want, but this is the way it really does happen. And do not. I tell Marines, before you go see a therapist, talk to your spouse, and if you don't have one, talk to somebody who loves you and will not judge you. And watch
what
happens.
One of the first things Eugene, after he and I actually got to know each other a little bit, he said, how much does your wife know about your experiences? I said, well, after 30-something years, she knows a good bit. But the first 30-something years, she didn't know doodly squat about it. So he just chuckled, you know, because it didn't matter. Hey, we'd been down that same road, you know, Eugene having fought all over Okinawa. I said, Gene, I didn't fight all over Okinawa, but I felt like I knew every square inch of NTA anyway.
You know, when you read, you know, his story, Jack, I saw his wife and his sons being interviewed and talking about, you know, he would get up and write about his nightmares, and they said there was 1,000 handwritten pages that ultimately became With the Old Breed. Now, I would tell you.
Written in his New Testament.
Right. And so.
Written on the edges of the pages of his New Testament.
Right. Yeah. That's where he kept his notes. And then he'd have nightmares, and he'd get up and he'd write about it and then use his notes. And then, but you know, and anybody's read the book is pretty graphic. It's a pretty brutal and honest, chronicle of how they lived on a daily basis. Now, that's what made it into the book. Could you imagine what the handwritten manuscript was like? Holy shit, right?
Oh, yeah.
And yet he, you know, what changes his life is when he allows his wife to type it, right? And then she knows.
And she finally understands for the first time what he went through.
Right, yeah. And most importantly, more probably important than what she knew, is the fact that he let her in. And what he felt. And so it's a recurring theme, right? If you do this, then these things happen. And these are all tough guys, you know, tough guys, and that have been through a lot. And we all learn the same thing. And the only thing I've done, Jack, is I've kind of pulled this stuff together because of all the interviews I've done with people and say, hey, look, man, I've listened to this shit for 3.5 years, and I'm going to tell you the truth. And everybody I interview tells me a different version of this story. And I can tell you without a doubt that if you do these things, you can live a great life in spite of anything you might have been through. You can touch other people's lives. And we can be what we ought to be as Marines. And they look at me, at first they look at me like I'm crazy. Yeah. Who's that old crazy?
Well, wisdom comes with age, at least it's supposed to. And too often, as with each of us, that we're of combat age, and maybe the not having that wisdom at that time may have been a good thing, because we were actually able to leave yesterday as yesterday, and it wasn't until we left Vietnam that all those yesterdays caught up with us.
Right. Well, it's different when you're living in every day. You've got to be able to wall it off to be able to go do it tomorrow.
That's right.
That's a different skill set. But, you know, we've never been taught this stuff. And that's the cool thing about teaching it now to young Marines, is when you teach it to them. And that sergeant who came up to me, I mean, can you imagine, Jack, when he said to me, 90 days after I had your class, my father committed suicide. And because of that class, I knew what to do. I knew what not to do. And I knew what to do for me and my friends and my family. You can imagine, because you've lived it, I was the happiest human being on the planet at that point. All the shit that you've been through, that things you've taught me and other Marines have taught me, spared a young Marine from going through that, and he started on the back side of all that experience. And it's just the coolest thing in the world.
It's if we look at, of course, you know, the Marine Corps has their way of doing everything, and thinking back, I remember when we were putting our book together several years ago, I couldn't think of a single instance in my training, and I felt like we were trained as well as anybody. But how to how to deal with issues like that. Of course, you know, ours was strictly the mission. The thing that is the most important thing is the mission and completing that mission. But not one time were we ever talked to about, in the instance of casualties, how do you deal with that? That was something that we just, that was really OJT. And it was quick OJT. And it was something that, that the new guys had to be indoctrinated into their very first day so that they would not have a negative impact on, because seeing guys the first time that are your close buddies and all getting blown to pieces, you don't want somebody just totally losing it. And I never had that happen. I not a single time did I ever have it happen that somebody just totally lost it, even though, you know, we had casualties as bad as you could get.
Jack Riley has been my guest here. Did you get out as a sergeant?
Yeah.
Sergeant Jack Riley, United States Marine Corps. He was a corporal squad leader in Vietnam?
Corporal squad leader, yeah. 0311.
India Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. Which platoon, which squad?
That's it. Yeah, 2nd platoon, 2nd squad.
2nd platoon, 2nd squad, India Company.
Well, I was, you know, I told you that, you know, once I got my 3rd Purple Heart, our new first sergeant, after I got out of the hospital, came out to the field and escorted me back to the Camp Carroll, because I was supposed to get out of there with 3 Purple Hearts. And, having a brand new first sergeant and a brand new commanding officer, and, you know, that's quite a shock to come back to after come back after losing that many guys in battle. But thank goodness, Top Bryce Lee, he was, he was a Marine's Marine. And, you know, thinking back with all of the conversations I had with him, and he was also a frozen chosen Marine. And, man, this dude had so much, wisdom to him at the time. He was, of course, he was only like 38, 39 years old, but, you know, to me being 22, 23, he's an old man. but he was a very wise old man. But I'll tell you one of these days when we're off the regular year program, I'll tell you what he tried to do to hoodwink me into staying in the Marine Corps. He was quite a character.
Well, he knew good people, right? He did not want to see you get out and go on your way. Jack, first of all,
well, he was also back. He made it to that first reunion, and we had set up the next reunion that we were going to have, which was going to be close by here. And I talked to him the night before, just being sure that, you know, his travel plans were all set and he was going to be able to come down. And he said, "Oh, sure, I'll be there. And then that next day, his wife called and told us he had died of aneurysm that just exploded.
Shit.
So, thank goodness I got to be with him at that first reunion, and I'm telling you, it's having that experience of just being together with somebody that you admired that much, that you really love that much, and to spend that little amount of time with them. Then, you know, following up with that, all the telephone calls that you get, and all the ragging, I was still I was still just a snuffy, and he talk to me that way just about all the time. And, but that relationship is something that I treasured then, and I treasure it to this day. That's the kind of brotherhood that you really develop in the Marine Corps.
Jack, first of all, again, thank you very much for taking what's been about 2 hours and 11 minutes of your time today and coming on and talking about what I consider one of the most important issues with all the other stuff relative to the military aside. The way we go about our lives and the way that the potential we have to change the country, to change our community, to set an example as veterans, I think is huge. I think it's a huge opportunity. Giving other people this wisdom that comes from our culture is one of the coolest things going these days, I think. And so you've been a great inspiration to me, and I just want to thank you for coming on today and doing it.
Thanks, Matt. Always enjoy talking to you.
All right, bud. Have a good one.
All right. Talk to you later.
There you have it. Right. The one and only. I did not intend for that to happen. What the hell? Jack Riley. Wow. Now, I did intend to talk to him, but that was, you know, that's the cool thing about this. Why I love doing it. All right, let me read you some emails. First of all, I have to do some shithole weather updates, and I'll do those in a minute. Here's one from Tsunami Lady. Oh, my gosh. This from a map reader? You need a time zone map. I know. Alabama throws me for a loop. In my mind's eye? I mean, it's just inside Georgia. That's got to be the East Coast, right? It's not Central Time Zone. But you know what? Thank God that he came on. Here's another email from Ohio Man. I sent you that book. The book that Jack's talking about, Operation Buffalo, The Fight for the DMZ, is sitting right in front of me. Yeah, and Ohio Man sent it to me. If you remember my mention of that, but I figured it was via a fluke that Nolan was a fellow student at Missouri while I was a senior. I looked him up and paid him a visit. Passionate guy. It sucks that he's gone, thinking about what he didn't get written. Yeah, he's a prolific writer about Vietnam and history. Here's another one from the Tsunami Lady. Keep doing this, Mac. Keep bringing these men like Jack back on to tell more of their stories. I thought his first interview was good. This was great. Luke and I need to head south and visit him someday. That's from Libby. Libby is a huge part of post-traumatic winning. Now, I'm not saying that has Libby never told me what she told me, that this wouldn't happen, because at some point it would have happened. But Libby is the first person that really made me understand the power of giving, which is the signature piece. It's the mandatory piece of post-traumatic winning. And as I say to Marines, I come here to make you feel good about yourself, although I'm okay with it if you do. I came here to teach you a skill, and that you could use that skill to touch the lives of other people. And in doing that, you're going to change your own life forever, as well as changing theirs. Yeah, so Libby, huge part of this. Some shithole weather updates. I don't know why I forget shithole weather now. So let me take care of it now. From Webster, Massachusetts. Under orders to hold in place, awaiting further word. Dark and 44 degrees, winds are out of the southwest at 6. Clear most of the day, clouds building in the afternoon. There's a wind advisory in place for Thursday from 05 to 1800. If it's real, there's an R in it, apply to advisory? No, an advisory is just an advisory. It's advice. Yeah, advisory advice. this might happen. That's Chris from Webster. From Nancy. A wet Wednesday in Pleasantville, Pennsylvania. An hour's drive from Erie, PA. Currently 54 degrees, heading to 56. Winds out of the west at 10. Rain tapering off by early afternoon. Cloudy, windy, and cool through the day. And then in Vacaville, California, from Vacaville, man. I'm back from elk hunting in Utah. Ah, that's why he was gone. Cold as shit there. Today in Vacaville, it's currently 45 clear with a slight breeze from the southwest at 7 miles an hour and a high expected of 75 degrees today. Big day, the elk hunters. If you're just tuning in, we talked mental health in the first hour. We talked community-based mental health, and I played some audio from a forum that went on at the University of Texas Southwest, in which two Indian PhDs that are working in Texas talk about the work they do and how this community-based approach, right, especially dealing with depression. 99% of the people don't need to go see a mental health professional. They're dealt with by general practitioners who talk about five things. Diet, exercise, disclosure, talking about it, exercise, and sleep. Every one of you can do that. You can be a general practitioner for somebody. And the good news is that means 99% of us are just struggling with it and can deal with it. All right? But you got to tell them the truth, and if you do that, you can change their life. So that's in hour one. So talk about that and some other stuff in hour one. And then in hour two, what we just concluded was Jack Riley. And just an awesome, as Libby said, just a great, great interview. And what I wanted to talk to him about was his journey after Vietnam comes home. And if you read Jack's bio, right, all he's done is he's give. He's given to people. Where did that come from? How has that changed? And he talked about that he didn't talk about Vietnam when he came home, and that he was in a doctor's office at the VA, and he's just talking to another guy who he doesn't even know. And he said, I left there and I felt so good. And he said, and that's when the idea of we got to get everybody together. Because if I feel that good talking to him, imagine what it'd be like talking to my friends. And he got his company together, and initially there was a squad reunion, and then that galvanized things to a company reunion, and then he's just touched more people as he's kind of grown that thing. So anyway, good on him. All right, we're gonna take a break. More of All Marine Radio. Coming up, I've got to switch computers because I've got to restart this one. So don't touch that dial. Don't do anything. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.